Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is Monday morning, November 12th. My name is Rob Doster. I have a fun show on the way for you today. I was able to connect with my guy, Dallin Cuff, who is an ESPN college basketball analyst. He does some color commentary. He does some studio work. He's a bright mind. And I decided to bring him back on the podcast, even though he is an Arsenal supporter, because he is that good at what he does. You're really going to enjoy this conversation. We go take a deep dive into Auburn. We talk a little bit about the problems that Kentucky is currently facing. We do go into Duke, and we also talk about Press Virginia and why they are not the same team that they have been in the past years. Before we get into that, I need to tell you guys about StockX. Ever wonder how to get the hottest new sneakers, the ones that barely hit shelves? Don't have the time to camp out for 3 days to get your hands on some Yeezys? The answer to your problems is here, and it is StockX, a revolutionary new marketplace for buying and selling 100% authentic sneakers, as well as streetwear, watches, handbags, whatever you're in the market for. Millions are already using StockX to find everything after it sells out, from the latest Yeezys to every retro Jordan on the planet to the hottest new streetwear from brands like Supreme, Bape, Palace. There's even a marketplace to buy and sell pre-owned, excellent condition handbags and watches from high-end brands like Louis Vuitton, Gucci, Rolex, Tudor. They're all there. So how does it work? It's simple. It's like buying and selling stock. Buyers set their bidding price, sellers set their asking price, and when those prices match, the deal is made. The site includes real-time market data for you to use, allowing you to see how much an item has sold for in the past, how much it's selling for now, where the best deals can be had. It includes breakdowns by size. You can see weekly highs and lows. You can see quarterly averages. Savvy buyers are going to be able to find deals. And here's the best part. You don't need $1,000 to get a pair of shoes that you like, even a trendy pair. This is what I did. I'm not what you would call a sneakerhead, but I know what I like. I'm an Air Max guy. So I went to StockX.com/collegebb, and I found the pair that I loved. The colors matched a few different outfits. I was able to wear the shoes, you know, more than one day a week. They're perfect. So I put in a lowball bid, $50 less than what the asking price was. And 2 weeks later, I got the confirmation email that said the deal had been made. I got my sneakers at the price that I wanted to spend. If you're not a bargain hunter like I am, then you can just meet the seller's price and the shoes will be shipped your way. Most importantly, StockX is the middleman that ensures total anonymity between the buyer and the seller. They have a team of experts that verify every item is 100% authentic. Don't get burned by fakes ever again, and do as I did. Go to StockX.com/collegebb and get your sneaker fix. That's StockX.com/collegebb. StockX. Now you know. And now let me welcome back onto the podcast Mr. Dallin Cuff, who is an analyst at ESPN. Dallin, what's going on, my man? How you doing?
Not much, Rob. Good to be here. Thanks for having me back. Always fun to chat with you.
I'm looking forward to this chat, and not just because of the college basketball stuff. Last time I had you on, we talked a little bit about soccer and a little bit about, I know you're an Arsenal supporter, so give me your early takes on the Unai Emery era and whether or not you think that this run that Arsenal is on can last.
Let's just start with I'm pleasantly surprised. I thought Emery was a hire because his success in Spain in particular was doing more with less. And I kind of thought that was what the Arsenal brass wanted. They've been obviously very, let's say, cost conscious, even beyond Wenger. The administration in general has not spent at the requisite level that the other teams are spending in that league. And I thought this was kind of like a value play, trying to find a way to get more with less. And I've been amazingly surprised. He's been fantastic, changed the mentality of these guys. They continue to go down and find a way to battle back to, you know, get 3 points or get 1 point like they did at the weekend. And it's been impressive. And I think they have now, 14 straight unbeaten. It's been a lot of fun. As an Arsenal fan, I think many people lose their minds real quick and start thinking championship. I'm just hoping for the top four, which is going to be tough enough just to get back into Champions League play. You know, those Thursday, Europa Thursdays where you're playing in, some former Soviet bloc country aren't the most fun to watch. Not what I'm looking for. So I hope they get back in the Champions League. It's been a lot of fun to to enjoy them early in the season, and it's been a quick progression, to say the least. It's been cool.
I would love to rub in those Thursday Europa League games a little bit to you, but I got a feeling
you're
going to
be joining me shortly, my friend.
No, look, here's what's going to happen, and I'm calling my shot right now, and I want your thoughts on this. So Spurs are going to go out on next Wednesday on the 20th of November, and they're going to beat Inter, right? Which means that they're going to be tied on points in the Champions League group, which means that all they have to do is go into the Camp Nou. And win at Barcelona, and it's going to happen, and it's going to be one of the most glorious days of my soccer fandom experience. And I have to keep telling myself that just so I don't think about how depressing it's going to be to see this team end up back in the Europa League, back playing on Thursdays, back playing teams that I don't even know how to pronounce. So I'm telling myself this. I'm calling my shot now, and I'm just it's going to happen, man. You got to believe.
You can believe you're going to be pretty heartbroken come match day six, I think. And on top of that, you would be better off, honestly, if they just went into fourth place and they just call it a wrap, because that would help them in the EPL at least. It's hard to play those Thursday games and then turn around and play Sunday in the Premier League, where every game is competitive. That league can diminish your chances of making the top four. So if I were you, I would almost say, like, hey, let's just crap out. Let's just be done with the competition. Hit fourth place behind PSV, and then just let's focus on EPL. That would be the best bet, in my mind.
Well, you're ignoring the fact that they're going to go into the Camp Nou and win, so.
I am definitely ignoring that. I'm also ignoring the fact that Inter can't beat PSV and goal difference and all the other things. But I'm glad you got it all figured out. We will find out here in about 3 or 4 weeks.
Yes, we will. Yes, we will. Any other thoughts?
Actually,
we need
to find out. But you got to beat Inter first. We'll find out on the 20th real quick.
Yeah, I know, right? There's no way that's going to happen, because that's not the way the Spurs work. Actually, no, I'll tell you what. This is what's actually going to happen, because this is how Spurs really do work. They're going to beat Inter, and then they're going to go into the Camp Nou, and then they're going to score first. And I'm going to be sitting there, I'm going to be watching it, and I'm going to be thinking that this is actually going to happen. And then they're going to give up two goals in like the final 8 minutes to lose and crush all my hopes and dreams. And that's just the way that it's going to work. That's the way that I have to think as a Spurs fan, because I just have to set myself up for failure.
Yeah, that makes total sense. See, the whole positivity and optimism you gave me before, that was just, that seems crazy. That is a fan that's not a Spurs fan. The second scenario, I think, actually will happen, and you've been conditioned to believe it, and I think it'll actually come true. So I'm sorry in advance for that.
I just got to tell myself that moral victories are still victories, right?
I guess so, man. I guess tough life we live when you're not Man City.
Yeah. All right, man, let's talk a little bit about college basketball. Give me your... this is going to be the Monday Overreactions podcast. But before we get into that, give me any overarching thoughts that you have after the first week. Obviously, we're going to talk a little bit about Duke and Kentucky and all that. But beyond those teams, is there anybody that's really impressed you, anyone that surprised you, anyone that's really disappointed you?
I think my biggest takeaway this year, I think we're going to have more quality teams, like high-end, really good teams. And Kansas is obviously capable of that. Duke is capable of that. Despite how Kentucky started in their first two games, I think they can be capable of that. We can talk more about them. I think Gonzaga is my preseason national champion. That team, I think, is going to be cutting down the nets in Minnesota. I think Tennessee is a team that's got everybody coming back, the right mentality, the toughness. North Carolina's season. Nevada's a team that everybody keeps talking about, and we'll see if they can put it together in the non-conference. They don't have a really tough non-conference slate before they get the Mountain West play. So we'll see what that team's all about as they develop. But I just think there's more high-end level teams this year. That's going to make it a lot of fun in terms of who's going to be able to make a run at the end of this thing and who's going to be emerging as dominant teams. As teams that have impressed me, Auburn first and foremost. I mean, to have Washington come in, a Washington team that's got a lot of hype and has a lot of guys coming back from that group and play that 2-3 zone that can throw some teams. Mike Hoffman's crew went into Auburn and just got shellacked. And it was a prototypical Bruce Pearl Auburn team performance. You know, Jared Harper and Bryce Brown weren't great in terms of shooting the ball. I think they combined for like 6-for-22, but they set the tempo defensively. And they just sped up Washington right away. They got in him, turned him over, and the whole team, they were just coming at him in waves. 30 points off turnovers. Samir Dowdy, the transfer from VCU. It's really interesting to watch him play, because obviously covering VCU a lot earlier in my career when I was at NBC, we had the A-10. I did a bunch of their games. And even the first year at ESPN, I was in Richmond like 5 times that year or something. And seeing him develop from that player to where he's at now, he just seemed like he really understands the game. He made the right pass a lot of times, particularly against that zone, to not hold the ball, to make the right pass delivered on time, on target, to help his teammates get a shot or be a hockey assist type guy, the pass that led to the pass. He was really good. Chuma Okeke was excellent. Having Austin Wiley come back and be available in that game, you know, coming back from last year with the FBI and all that stuff. And D'Angelo Purifoy still sitting out. So this Auburn team looks really good, and they just dominated a Washington team that has talent and has some guys. They got Noah Dickerson in foul trouble. He really struggled, and they just dominated that game. So Auburn has been really impressive to me. Yeah, Buffalo was the team that – sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say Auburn, I'm 100% there with you, and one of the overreactions that I was going to ask you about was whether or not you thought Auburn was the best team in the SEC.
That is tough for me. I'm part of the media poll for the SEC. I picked Tennessee, and I'm going to stick with that. That was the co-champ last year. But both those teams, it wouldn't surprise me at all if Auburn won the SEC, not even in the slightest. I think those two teams are the teams that are best equipped to handle that conference right now. I do think that's the best conference in the country, which some people take a step back about. I think the SEC and the ACC are right there. The SEC just, I think, is slightly deeper. The back end of the SEC may be tougher to get wins, especially on the road compared to some of the ACC teams, like ACC teams on the back end. So I would say the SEC is an absolute gauntlet, and Kentucky is obviously going to be there, I think, because they have the talent they're trying to figure out how to put together. I think right now Tennessee and Auburn, we already know what they're about. The question is how high is their ceiling? And their ceiling is pretty high. But Kentucky's ceiling may be higher, but we don't still know quite what they're about. They're still trying to figure that thing out. They have more veteran players, yes, but offensively, you know, especially in the first half of the Southern Illinois game, just a really a team that's just trying to figure it out in terms of playing too fast, trying to force shots, do things on their own. And I think they had like 14 turnovers, forcing bad positions a lot of times in that Southern Illinois game. In the first game against Duke, they were shell-shocked. I mean, on their heels, Duke came out, made some threes. They unraveled, started taking tough shots, doing it on their own. So they need to figure it out. I think their ceiling is high because they have more maybe raw talent and a couple pros. But Auburn and Tennessee are right. We know they're going to be good. So I would not be shocked at all if either one of those teams win the SEC.
The big surprise for me with Auburn has been Chuma Okeke. I think that you mentioned mm-hmm. him. And
yep.
Him and Anfernee McLemore, to me, are the pieces that kind of make that Auburn system work, because they're like 6'8". They're athletic. Okeke has 5 blocks through 2 games. Anfernee McLemore actually led the nation last season in block percentage before he had that broken ankle. And mm-hmm. they both can make threes. I think Okeke is, 6-for-8 from three so far this year. They both shot 39% from three last season. And what they do is they allow Auburn, one, to be switchable defensively, two, to be able to run a transition, three, to be able to space the floor offensively, and do all of that while having two guys on the floor that are going to be able to protect the rim. And when you put all of that together, combined with the way that Jared Harper plays and, like you said, the tone that him and Bryce Brown set defensively in the transition, and, you know, Samir Dowdy stepping up and looking like a better player than he was at VCU, and the return of Purifoy and Wiley, and you put all that together, and that's a very, very good and very entertaining basketball team. They are – I did not – last season, it took me a while to kind of get on that bandwagon, right? And I didn't realize just how much fun they are to watch. And now it's like when Auburn's on TV, that's going to be one of the games that I lock into. Just, you know, they fire up threes, 100%. They get up and down the floor. So I'm 100% there with you all. I actually think they are the best team in the SEC.
That environment, too, that they got going down there, that game was – I mean, the Huskies, Washington walked into a buzzsaw. That place was absolutely rocking. And you're right, they play a fun and engaging brand of basketball people want to see. And it was great to see, too. You mentioned McLemore, him coming back from injury and being – and I've said it a couple times on air, as they get healthy, they seem healthier than I thought. Bruce Pearl made comments about 2 weeks ago talking about how him and Samir Dowdy, who's coming back from a little bit of an injury, too, they were – working them back slowly, but they look good, and they're logging, you know, minutes that they would pretty much in any situation now, because they do run 8, 9, 10 deep at you, and I do think throwing Wiley in the mix too is going to give them at times a different look, because you just said they do those two guys, Okeke and McLemore, give you guys rim protectors. They can get out and run, but if you want to play through Wiley at times, you can do that. You can go into the half court, you can play inside out through him at times. A different type of guy. So Bruce Pearl has a ton of things at his disposal, and that game also showed you that you don't need Brown and Harper they don't have to always score. And that's how that team's built. Somebody can drop 20 on you at any point in time, and that's what makes that team really dangerous.
Yeah, you mentioned the environment. It was crazy there. And that is an Auburn basketball game on a Friday night, and it was rocking. Yep. That's awesome. That's really cool to see. You know, the SEC is not exactly known for having great basketball programs or great basketball environments. But I think Bruce Pearl You know, that's what he does, right? Like, he gets people involved. When Tennessee was, when he had them rolling, Thompson Bowling Arena was one of the most fun environments in that conference. So I think you got to give him a lot of credit with this and getting this thing going. Like, he doesn't really have any guys that, maybe, I guess Wiley was a five-star prospect. But beyond that, like, the guys that he's having the most success with aren't necessarily the guys that jumped out on the recruiting rankings or that people knew were going to be college stars immediately.
Yeah, for sure. And that's why he does deserve credit with his staff, too, in terms of developing those guys and getting them to play better, learning how to play a style of basketball they want to play, and then working on their individual skills and getting better. He's great always to work on the sidelines, too, just hyping the crowd up. You see it at least four or five times a game. He's throwing his arms in the air, getting those people riled up. And he does. He's created a good environment. And the SEC, like, that's where they are. Their investment in the coaches has benefited it, quickly, really. They've turned around from a team that got two teams into the tournament 3 years ago to a team that got eight teams in last year, get eight teams again in this year, and bring in another guy, great guy, my guy, Tom Crean, going to Georgia. Hopefully he turns it around. You know, I know he's working hard. He's working social media, getting the fans involved. I'm excited to see his team play a little bit more. But that's where that league has made a big jump, is they've invested in great coaches, and that's helped turn a lot of these programs around that have the resources, that have the assets monetarily. And now they're investing in basketball like they do football, and it's a different game.
Are those Wednesday night studio sessions going to be a little bit lonely now without Tom Crean there?
Yeah, it'd be a bummer to have Coach Crean not there, but I got a new partner in crime. We'll be in the mix. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say who it is, but it's not like anything. I don't think it's like a secret or anything, but Sean Farnham and I will be
all right
doing stuff and for Wednesdays and Thursday nights once we get into league play, so it'll be a good time with fun.
That's a former guest of the podcast, Sean Farnham.
He's the man. It'll be a lot of fun. He just called the Yale Corner California game out in China. Bulldogs.
Your Ivy League boys.
The Bears. Yeah. Me and him were talking before the game. I'm like, I don't know what the spread's going to be on this game, but I would bet the farm on Yale, and they dominated by double digits.
Real quick before we actually talk more basketball, I've always wanted to ask people this. What is the biggest difference for you when you're calling a game kind of as the color commentator versus when you're just talking hoops and sitting in the studio? Which do you like more? Is there a different way that you prepare for each one? Just kind of talk me through a little bit of that.
Yeah, they actually the difference with the two is let's equate it to a college level thing. If you're doing studio, you have to be it's like having like a 200 level course on 40 or 50 teams. You got to really have your pulse on everything that's going on that night, that week, what just recently went on with any team in the top 25, storylines, players. It's kind of like you have to have a good broad understanding of many different things because anything can come up. Now, you'd have your rundowns with the producer and the host and stuff. You know what you're supposed to talk about, but it's through the course of the night. Sometimes you have the 20-minute fills or 15-minute fills. People are just throwing questions at you. Things are happening. So you got to have a real good understanding of a lot of the broad landscape of college basketball, which is a deep and lengthy bunch of stuff to know. When you're doing a game, it's like a grad-level course. You are focused and deep and ensconced in that game, in those two teams, and you have to be really aware of all the things that have happened with players 1 through 12, essentially, what they can and cannot do, where their games have developed, where they need more out of them, what the coaches are asking of them, their preparation, going to practice, going to the shoot around, really understanding all the things that are going on with those two teams. So you are able to give, I always say to people when you're calling a game, you want to be able to give the most novice person in the world insight, education, entertainment, and the most advanced analysts, fellow analysts, my peers, while they're watching the game, they're also somehow learning something about that team, about that player, about that play that they may not have known. So that's the difference. And that's what makes it fun to do both, because you're deep diving on certain teams and certain conferences, and you're also keeping it very broad across the country. So I enjoyed my role in the fact that I get to do both, because it kind of keeps you engaged in everything while also keeping you on the, out pounding the pavement, if you will, with the coaches at the games, at the venues, experiencing those things.
So you mentioned grad level caliber courses for calling a game like that. Let me ask you a grad level caliber question here. If you are, let's say John Calipari called you up tomorrow and he said, Dallin, mm-hmm. I need you to tell me how to fix my team. I need you to tell me what I need to do to make Kentucky great again. What is your answer?
That's a heck of a question. Now, I always say this. I haven't been at any practices for Kentucky. So it's hard to answer that question because I don't know even a fraction of what he knows about his guys and his players. That said, what we have seen in their exhibition games, which I take a little bit of a grain of salt, Now you have two games on wax. You've got 80 minutes against the most talented team we've seen, you know, in terms of just out of the gate in college basketball in recent memory. And then you have in Duke, and then you have a Southern Illinois team who's picked near the top of the Missouri Valley, veteran squad going into your building, but are not scared of you at all. I would say what needs to be fixed is they need to have an understanding on offense of what they're trying to do. And right now, they at times get sped up and just play incredibly too fast and take not even the first good shot, just the first shot that a guy thinks he can make goes up. Especially, like I said earlier, in the first 20 minutes of that Southern Illinois game, most of the Duke game was like that, where they got into this. It was a little bit like watching a park game. Like, dude just coming up and just doing stuff. I would say they need to have a better understanding, to focus on getting it to the second and third side, get that ball reversed, make the defense move. When they're not in transition, when they're in transition, they're great. And their defense, admittedly, was better with this more veteran group, a couple sophomores and Quade Green and P.J. Washington and Nick Richards, obviously Reed Travis, grad transfer coming from Stanford. They were better defensively in the first two games, but offensively they were pretty far behind. Now, when they get in transition, they're really good. I'm talking about in the half court. They need to find ways to play at times through Reed Travis when he's on the floor, and then at times they have to, again, reverse the ball, use their skills, understand when to attack, and understand the opportunities that are presented to them through the course of their offense, through the course of their just general actions. And they have the talented players to take over at times. Keldon Johnson, a freshman, it's great to have a freshman that doesn't – you don't need to – usually to teach the first thing is how to compete for 40 minutes and how to compete in practice actually first, then how to compete in a game for 40 minutes and how to play hard for 40 minutes. He does all those things better than most freshmen in the country. He's wired to compete. He's wired to play hard. Kid has a ton of talent. So excited to see him. Ashton Higgins is a good freshman as well. They have the different pieces around these guys. I think it's better having an understanding of when to go, how to go, and who's got the best opportunity. And that takes a little bit of time, it seems, right now. And it looks like the pressure of some of the moments, particularly against the Duke game, got to them. And that's something that hopefully they learn as they go along, that you got 40 minutes. It's a long game. You can't waste possessions. You can't play too fast or haphazard, because that's just playing your teammate in your opponent's hands.
My biggest concern with them 80 minutes into the season is the point guard spot. And I think that kind of touches on some of what you were alluding to. I don't think Emmanuel Quickly is ready to – he can score at this level, and I think we saw that against Southern Illinois, but I don't think he's ready to run an offense. I think that at some point they need to have Quade Green on the floor to provide a little bit more playmaking and a little bit more leadership. But Quade, to me, is at his best when he's kind of – a secondary ball handler, kind of the way that, when Quinn Cook was playing off of Tyus Jones on that 2015 mm-hmm. Duke team. I think that's the role that Quade is probably best at with this team, because not only does it give you a second playmaker, I think the best teams in the country these days have 2 point guards on the floor together, but it also gives you a little bit of shooting and a little bit of floor spacing, even if it takes away from some of what they can do defensively. And then Ashton Higgins, you know, I love his competitiveness. I love the way that he defends, but he is just a mess right now on the offensive end. He very much looks like a freshman that reclassified to get to school early. So I'm sure that he'll get there, and I'm sure that how hard he plays earns him minutes from Coach Cal. But, I mean, right now I think they have to have Quickly and Green on the floor together, and I think that there are still question marks about those two guys and how impactful they can be. You know, it's weird saying this, but Kentucky has 3 5-star point guards on the floor, and they still have point guard problems.
True. Now, but bear in mind, though, as you just went through, those guys are young. I mean, Quade Green's only a sophomore. The other guys are freshmen. So the one point I would challenge you on, I don't necessarily want to take the ball out of Quickly's hands 80 minutes in. I want him to work through these problems. I want him to understand and figure it out in this part of the season, because their non-conference schedule isn't exactly a gauntlet. I believe they've got like North Dakota, VMI, Winthrop is a good team, Tennessee State, Monmouth. I mean, they don't really play anybody of real consequence until looks like UNC on December 22nd. So if there's a time these guys can struggle, because in the end, they're going to beat teams purely on their athleticism, their ability to play in transition. At times they'll turn you over, and they have talent. They'll find a way to win a lot of these games. The question is, are you seeing the things improve that you're outlining? Point guard play, taking care of the ball, understanding offense, being able to score in the flow of the offense in the half court. I want those guys to fail now, so when you get into SEC play and you get into December, later December, they're not making the same mistakes. So they've got to play through their mistakes. They've got to play and understand them and then improve upon them.
I agree. That's a fair point. What about PJ Washington and Reed Travis? You know, I think that it's also a little bit of a concern that, and this isn't a shot at Nick Richards or EJ Montgomery, but you don't want Nick Richards and EJ Montgomery to be the two best big guys that you have, because you want those two best big guys to be Reed Travis and PJ Washington. PJ's been a mess. I don't think he's been really good at all in the first two games. I don't know if there's something going on there, but it looks like he's taking a little bit of a step back. And Reed, you know, he was good against, well, he put up numbers against Duke. I don't know if he was necessarily great in that game. And then he just disappeared against Southern Illinois. What, you got any answers there? Any clarity for me?
Well, yeah, he had foul trouble in the first half of the Southern, excuse me, the Southern Illinois game. Which threw off his role. I don't think he played like the final 12 minutes, but he put two fouls, something like that. And in the second half, they didn't really go to him much. And that's where I would think, if I am Coach Cal, I want to find a way to play through Travis. He doesn't have to be the main dude because they have other guys. He just isn't like Stanford again, where he had to get a touch every time down, or basically they failed in terms of their executing their offense. But I think he needs to be have a bigger presence in the game. I think they need to find ways, especially when I'm talking about playing offense, you know, and finding a way to help some guys understand where to score and how to score, to play through him. You throw the ball on the block at times, he's going to draw a double. And right away, that's going to benefit his team because he makes good decisions out of double team. Sometimes he can beat him on his own. So I think they're just obviously trying, like I keep saying, trying to figure out how this thing all works together when you're playing a higher level of competition and teams that have scouted you and teams that have your game plan ready and teams are coming in with a real thought of how to stop these guys. And playing in the Bahamas, not the same thing. You know, playing exhibition games, not the same thing. We saw it twice in 80 minutes with the lights on against quality opponents, and it didn't look too good. So with Reed Travis, I think you got to, you know, continue to, I would say, make him more of a focal point. PJ Washington, it's the same thing. You not the same thing. It's different, the fact that sometimes you hear your name talked about so much and how you're going to make this big leap and how great you're going to be and how impactful you're going to be, and it doesn't go too well, and you start to force a little bit. I think he's got to continue to just play with confidence and find a little bit of a rhythm. But also understand that he's not, based on how much talent other players they have around him, he doesn't have to perform. He doesn't put the pressure on himself. He's got to relax and play the game because we know how talented he is. We've seen flashes of him in the past. He just needs to go out there and play the game and be a little more, I think, relaxed. I think he's forcing the issue at times a bit.
Do you think Kentucky did they ever get back to the point where they're a top five team in that conversation? Are they still there for you? Where do you kind of see them right now? What do you see their ceiling end up being?
Oh, yeah, I think they can absolutely be a top-five team. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind. What we've seen from Coach Cal's teams in recent years, and yes, some of them have been younger, but we're still talking now. We're talking about, this is the concept of college basketball right now. We talk about sophomores like they're seniors. Like, you still got a lot to learn. You still have a lot of steps to make. And each year, things are different. This is the first time they played with a new group of guys. So you knew what it was your freshman year, but now you're in a different group as a sophomore, different role, different responsibility, different understanding, different dudes around you. So how do you react now? So I think we've seen Coach Cal's teams a lot of times improve greatly through the course of the year, particularly in the back half of the year as they go through the end of SEC play. We've seen like some pretty big jumps from his teams. That said, I mean, this team still has top five capability to me. They have depth. They have some veteran players. They have some guys that have done it before. I think they just need the time to figure it out. I think if you asked me that question in January, I would give you the same answer. This team still has top five potential. They may be there by the time we get to January in terms of their performances. They're not there now, but they may be there in 2 months, which is earlier than they've been there in the past with some of these teams that are even younger than us.
I think the one thing I would say about Kentucky is this. I don't know who on that team, if you're an opposing coach, you're scared of, right? Let's say if you're playing Duke next, right, and you have to put together your scouting report, you have to sit there and say, okay, how am I going to stop R.J. Barrett? Well, I got to put my best wing defender on him. How am I going to stop Zion Williamson? Well, I have to put my second best wing defender on him. How am I going to stop Cam Reddish? Well, then I'm going to have the worst wing defender that I have guarding him. And you kind of go through that, and you're saying to yourself, okay, I don't know how I'm going to stop these guys. This is terrifying to me. I don't know how you look at somebody on Kentucky's roster and say, like, I don't know how I stop them. I don't know what I'm – if you're an opposing coach, I don't know what scares you about that lineup. And I think it's partly because I don't know if they have a star right now. I don't know if they necessarily have a go-to guy. I don't know if they know who their go-to guy is. I think that Keldon Johnson is probably the best player. But to me, he's got a little bit of Miles Bridges in him where he's at his best if he's, like, the second or third option. Does that make sense? Like, I think he is an elite role player and at his best when you ask him to – kind of play hard and be a secondary option offensively and not necessarily the go-to guy. So I think figuring that out a little bit is going to help them. And I think maybe role allocation, and a lot of that comes, like you said, a lot of that comes with time. And with John Calipari, the way that he can kind of get the best out of guys. But I don't know who you're scared of if you're game planning against them.
Well, you touched on something there right now. You said who's the go-to guy? Who are you scared of? You know, they don't know who the go-to guys are. They don't know what they're about yet. I think they're trying to still figure that. I keep saying figure that thing out. You did hit something that's really important we haven't talked about. They have to play harder. That's what. Like, let's just start there too. That Duke game, they got punched in the mouth and had no response for the most part. Southern Illinois is a team that, while it's well drilled, has toughness and is a team that's a veteran team. They still have dudes that are, you know, 6'10" to, you know, 6'8" to 7 foot almost, with huge wingspans. You can hurt teams on the offensive glass. They need to find ways to play harder and play with a determination, particularly when their offense is struggling on the offensive glass, which they've not been, they weren't elite at. They have the capability to do it in terms of their actual physical gifts, but you have to play with a high level motor. And that's something that Coach Cal said after the first game, like, wait, they didn't play hard enough, but they've got to find a way as a collective group to maximize some of those things that are just pure effort while they're still trying to figure out the X's and O's of stuff and getting guys playing with confidence. Some things you can always bring is the highest level of effort, which I don't think we've quite seen yet from that team.
All right, so Duke and Zion and R.J. Barrett, give me your whole take on them. My overreaction from watching two games is that I don't know how you beat them, and I think that if they're going to lose a game, my guess would be Virginia or maybe Syracuse, and beyond that, I don't know who can compete with them in college basketball this year.
Well, I'm not going that far yet because we've only seen two games. And the first game was ultra impressive, but the Army game showed a little bit right away in terms of you have to – when they sped up Kentucky and they turned them over 15 times, Kentucky played into it. Sometimes they took quick shots, which at times were just basically a turnover. They took quick threes, and that led to – or quick bad shots, and that just led to Duke back out in transition, just lighting them up. Army came in there with a veteran group of guys and a very, you know, it's Black Knights. They are focused. They are the cadets. They came in there with an understanding of the game plan on both sides of the ball, particularly in the first 25 minutes, 30 minutes, they executed that. They made Duke play longer. When they didn't beat them in transition, mind you, Duke's transition defense has to be better. And this is something that happens with young teams. Their transition defense was not great. Their half-court defense at times, Army got to places on the floor. They got where they wanted to get. They made threes, especially in the first half. They played confident. Duke didn't speed them up like they did Kentucky, because again, Kentucky was complicit in that. Army was not. Army came in and knew what they were going to do. Defensively, Army dug on a lot of the drives, got a hands on a lot of balls, forced six turnovers, created 12 points out of those six turnovers. And that's Army. That team is not athletic, not on your level in terms of their physical gifts, but because they played as a collective five, particularly defensive end, they made Duke struggle a little bit. So Duke's really ultra talented. Eventually talent won out, but Army exposed some things. It's a young team. You have to prepare and you have to play like you're capable of playing for 40 minutes, that's one of the battles with a young team. And in terms of who can beat this team, I think they could play Auburn in the second round of the Maui Invitational here in 10 days or so. I think that's probably the 20th of November. And they could lose that game because Auburn's going to come at you with veteran guys, waves of guys. We already talked about them. They're going to have pressure on them. They're going to have rim protectors. They're going to have stuff they have not seen at the collegiate level yet, playing as a collective group that is hungry to prove that they are, that we've already talked about, the best team in the SEC, and in their mind, the best team in the country. So what better opportunity than playing them in Lahaina Civic Center and really showing the country what they're all about? So that Auburn-Duke game would be a fantastic game, and I hope we get to see it. It's probably likely in the second round of that tournament. But this Duke team, as you go through it, consistency and understanding of every day and every possession, every 40 minutes, every possession is so critical within those 40 minutes. That's the hardest thing with a young team. So they showed the flash, but they have a ton of substance, but they're going to have to find a way to be consistent with that all year. And that's not going to happen. They're not going undefeated. I don't think there's any way they're going undefeated. The question is who's going to beat them and when, and there's going to be a lot of challenges. And the ACC is going to be really hard to beat. Like, playing a veteran team like UNC is tough. You already mentioned UVA. I mean, Virginia Tech can shoot the lights out. You get them on the wrong night, and they actually guard on the other end. That's going to be really tough. That all said, Duke is a hard matchup. You already went through reasons why. When Duke's making threes, I don't know how you guard them, but you can force them maybe into some turnovers. You can expose them defensively. We'll see. I think those are things that a team's going to have to show over time that's that young. They put great 80 minutes. I think great. A great 40 minutes, pretty good 20 minutes on tape in terms of that Army game. But they're by no means flawless, and they're going to have to continue to improve, particularly on the defensive end and defensive transition, to make sure that they don't lose to a team they're not supposed to lose to.
Yeah, we need that Auburn-Duke game to happen. That would be mm-hmm. absolutely incredible, especially in the Lahaina Civic Center, which is – have you ever been there? I've never been to Maui, but it's basically a high school gym, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I went there. I was 18 years old, actually. My cousin got married there, and my mom and dad, they're like, we're going to go. I'm like, we're going? So it was awesome. Went to Maui, and then I worked out every day. Every morning, I'd wake up, and I'd go to the Civic Center and just work on my game. I was going to college summer before my freshman year, but it's little, tiny, like, high school gym. Back then, too, they didn't have any AC. It was, like, 2001 still. If you remember, like, the older tournament, the floor would get wet and, like, get real like, condensation on it because it was hot, and we were there in the summer. But that place was cool. It was fun to be there.
Yeah, that gym is going to be rocking. That arena is going to be rocking, and I'm really looking forward to it. I just that game, I don't care what the line ends up being, you got to bet the over. And
I would take that for sure.
Yeah, and I think that actually might be my concern for Auburn in that one, in that I don't know if you want to get in a game where you're trying to run with Duke. I just the idea of Zion Williamson coming at you in transition is not something that I think is necessarily the most efficient way to win a basketball game. But I'm really looking forward to that. And you didn't even mention Gonzaga. They're going to be there too. So we could get.
They're on the other side of the bracket. So we could see Gonzaga. Oh, so yeah, you're right. Gonzaga Duke, I think, or Gonzaga Auburn, either one of the final would be fantastic.
Yeah, we're going to need that to happen. And, you know, I feel bad for those rims at in Lahaina. You know, they're already loose enough. Now they have Zion Williamson. Yeah, they are. Zion Williamson and R.J. Barrett coming to rip one of them down. All right, last thing, and then I'm going to let you get out of here. Buffalo, West Virginia. Are we going to see a better individual performance this season than what C.J. Massenburg did at West Virginia on Friday night?
It's tough given the environment. Going on the road into Morgantown in their second game of the season for Buffalo, with expectations, granted, you know, not nationally known, but they've got high expectations for themselves and people that know the game had that game circled to see what they were all about. And also, they didn't play well. Like, Buffalo as a team missed a ton of shots they normally make. You take Massenburg's threes out, they shot below 20% from three. And that's a team that can make shots and has three all-MAC players coming back and has been through some battles. They'd miss shots they normally make. They just weren't really sound offensively. What they were, though, is they were themselves. They play as one of the top 20 teams in the nation in terms of pace. They went at West Virginia. They just went right at them, didn't care, you know, broke their pressure. Again, missed shots they normally make, but went right at them. Only turned it over 11 times. They forced 19 turnovers from West Virginia. They also had 21 offensive rebounds. So they brought it with the effort stuff and the intangibles, but Massenburg had to play at an elite level, had to shoot at elite level because the rest of his teammates weren't playing to their normal level. And he was absolutely outstanding, particularly in the second half. In 26 in the second half, he made three threes in like four possessions where it was a game that was dicey. They were down most double digits most of the second half. He makes three threes, gets them going. It's a three that forces overtime, a huge one in OT. That scenario where you're on the road, you're trying to prove yourself, they have so few opportunities for quality, you know, non-conference wins that the committee even care about. It's almost like a must-win for them because if you get beat in the MAC final, you know, this now is a huge, you know, hopefully, if West Virginia performs at a level that's, you know, a tournament team worthy, which I think they will. They've got a long way to go, but I think they will. 13th ranked in the country was, I thought, overseed at the beginning or a bit of a reach at the beginning, and it showed it was a reach. But that's huge for Buffalo because come March, when they're looking at that selection committee, if they don't win their conference tournament, maybe they say, okay, these guys deserve to be in. That could help them so much. It was a phenomenal performance. Now, all that said, we're going to see other performances on par with that. It's the week one, but it's going to be up there and one that we should remember come March because that could have a huge impact on that team getting into the tournament if they need it. C.J. Massenburg was absolutely outstanding, took and made good shots. He had 7 offensive rebounds, 14 boards. He's a guard. He was fantastic.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing that I took away from that is that's where you kind of see the absence of Javon Carter, right? Like usually what for the last 4 years, basically what Bob Huggins would do is if you ever had somebody that got going like that, made a couple threes in a row, someone that came in averaging 20 points or whatever, you put Javon Carter on them and they disappear. And they don't necessarily have that guy. You know, Beadle Bolden's good. Brandon Knapper's a good player. Chase Harler's a good player. I think Jordan McCabe is eventually going to end up being a good basketball player, but none of them have the size or the strength or, you know, we talk about unicorns in basketball all the time. And Javon Carter doesn't necessarily have like any physical attributes that set him apart from kind of what a standard point guard is at the college level. But that dude is different in the way that he competes and the way that he defends, and just the you can't replicate that and you can't teach that. And I think that right there is kind of what we see West Virginia missing.
100%. And it was, I mean, him and Darius Miles, this dude's ability to impress in general was not effective, because it used to be Carter would, I used to hate this too. Like, it's, I will admit it, as a young point guard, especially when you turn a pressing team, you get that ball and you turn and face, you're like, God, we got to do this again. Like, sometimes it's just, it wears you down physically and mentally. And that's what Carter did. He knew he was going to come at you for 94 feet for the entire 40 minutes, and he's going to set the tone for his team, and they're going to follow. The problem is, you're right, they didn't have that. And Buffalo went right, like I said, again, tacked that pressure, was able to beat the pressure, and then not be fazed by it physically or mentally on the road, even when they were down double digits at times, just were never really out of control. And that's what Carter used to help do, is put instill fear into that guy across from him and instill anxiety. And when your point guard in the offensive end, when he's not comfortable, when he's not helping get things going to break the press, that's like you get rolling downhill, and that's how they were able to take teams out, just physically and mentally, because of how Carter approached the game. You're absolutely right. Not having that was huge, and that press was essentially ineffective. They out West Virginia. Their half-court pressure, Buffalo, was way better than West Virginia's full-court press. They were great on the half-court in terms of turning guys over and speeding guys up, and that just didn't happen on the other side.
Yeah, and the other part about Javon Carter is he would talk to you and let you know about it all throughout the game.
That's for sure.
I remember talking to people. I wrote something on them after they got knocked out of the Sweet 16 last year. And the one thing that he would do to really mess with people is he knew the plays that the other teams were running, and he would just get in the ear of whoever he was guarding and let them know, like, hey, you're supposed to be there. Hey, you missed this cut. Hey, you didn't, you're supposed to be over here and set this screen, and kind of get in their head that way. And there's not very many people that are able to do things like that as well as he did. So I definitely think that West Virginia is going to miss them. Dallin, I think that's all I got for you, man. I appreciate the time and I appreciate you coming on.
Good stuff as always, man. Looking forward to hearing you, reading your stuff and hearing you do a couple games on NBC. We get the winter here.
Yeah, definitely, man. All right, if you guys want to follow Dallin on Twitter, you can find him at Dallin Cuff, and you will be give him your schedule. When are you going to be on ESPN this year?
I don't know when this is going to air, but I was on yesterday. I'm on tonight, which is Monday, and then I'll be in Arkansas next week, calling the Indiana Arkansas game on ESPN. I think that's a Sunday game. It'll be interesting to see Romeo Langford in person. Arkansas, Daniel Gafford. They had a tough loss against Texas a couple days ago. And then I'll be doing the Advocate Invitational, which is Villanova's down there. And so we're doing the Villanova game, Memphis and Penny. And they're playing OK State. That's Thanksgiving Day. And then we'll have a semifinal game. And I have the final or the third place game. Dickie V and I split the games as analysts. So we'll see how it goes, and that's the schedule for now, I think.
It's never a good sign when you're 6 days into the season and you already don't know what day it is. So go rest up, man. I appreciate the time, and we'll catch up.
Thanks a lot, man. Have a good one.